from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. President Trump said during a Fox News town hall yesterday that he wants the nation opened up and raring to go by Easter, which falls on April 12th. California coronavirus cases are now above 2,600, including more than 1,000 in the Bay Area. And New York State says its case count, which is near 26,000, is doubling every 3 days. White House health officials say anyone traveling from New York City recently should self-quarantine for 2 weeks. We look at the effectiveness of quarantining and social distancing practices as the pandemic spreads and take your questions. Joining us is Dr. David Relman. He's a professor of medicine at Stanford and an infectious disease chief at the Palo Alto VA. Thanks for joining us, David Relman.
I'm happy to join you.
So, first, New York State has 10 times the coronavirus cases that California has. Why is this?
It's probably a combination of several factors. They, of course, have very high population density. The closer people are spaced, the more likely is transmission. They may also have certain social distancing practices or, you know, or forms of social interaction that are not conducive to control of the virus. So it may be a number of factors there.
Some infectious disease experts have said that California acting quickly, the Bay Area in particular, acting quickly may have helped us avoid something as dramatic as what's happening in New York. Do you agree? Is it too soon to say?
I agree that the measures that were taken were absolutely well-founded and prudent and, you know, didn't come a day too early. As to whether they're going to work, that's going to take a little bit of time. And I think people have to understand that a little bit of patience here is really important. The mathematics and the biology clearly say that if this is to work, we will not know for at least 2 and most likely 3 weeks. So, you know, you look at the start date for our shelter in place order, that was the night of March 16th, and it was issued for a 3-week period. So that takes us to April 7th. And again, the math and the biology say that we can't really know whether this has had a beneficial impact until about that time, 3 weeks later, so April 7th or so.
So then what's your reaction to the president saying that he wants the economy opened up by April 12th, especially when we're hearing our governor, Governor Newsom, say that that's earlier than any health expert he's consulting with is recommending?
Right, right. No, I think our president is operating a little bit in a sort of a wishful fantasy state that is just not grounded in the facts. The facts are that if we're going to have any real chance of slowing this down, of giving our healthcare system a chance to build up its capacity, and of minimizing the number of deaths here, we have to take these measures now. In fact, you could argue that we were a little bit late in doing so, and that others elsewhere in the country should be doing this as well. It doesn't mean that it has to continue for a year or a half year, but we have to give it a chance, and we have to do it right, and we have to do it seriously in order to learn how much of a benefit it might have.
Because what would happen if we ended the shutdowns, the quarantining measures in the U.S. that are currently happening in the U.S. by then, by April 12th?
We are currently on, right now, if you look at all of the curves, at the rates of new cases, the rates of deaths accruing, we are on an accelerating path that looks just like Italy. It looks just like Spain. It's pretty sobering when you look at the curves. If we do nothing, or if, for example, we were to back off on this early, well-founded effort, we are going to essentially ensure that we stay on this doomsday course, as far as I'm concerned.
We're talking with David Relman. He's a professor of medicine at Stanford and infectious diseases chief at the Palo Alto VA. Call us with your questions for him at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. What do you think of the president's call to open up the country in less than 3 weeks? A timeline that's hard to square with warnings from public health experts, including David Relman. You can post your questions or comments on Facebook, Twitter at KQED Forum, or email them to forum@kqed.org. David Relman, I mean, the president suggested that there will be dire consequences if economic sectors are not restored. He's saying that you cannot let the cure be worse than the disease. And I mean, on the face of it, that makes sense, right? Nobody wants that to happen. Nobody wants more death and devastation as a result of the economy basically being on ice for several weeks. But how do you even make those calculations during a pandemic like this when you say the numbers are accelerating, when the harm is still unclear?
Right, right. No, I mean, his larger concerns are perfectly, you know, reasonable and important. And I don't want to in any way suggest that we don't have to undertake some very careful balancing act between the control measures that we think will save lives and preserve the integrity of our healthcare system versus the countervailing measures that might rescue components of our economy. So it's really just it's a balancing act. And I think the issue right now is a little bit more patience would be quite important and wise. There are good methods, modeling methods, for sorting out whether each of the various measures that have been taken have had a positive impact or not, and likewise the economic measures that might be taken to rescue certain components of the economy. Those too can be modeled and studied. And so, I think all of those who have said, we need more data. We know we will have more data soon. This is not just a kind of a shot in the dark. Those are very valuable and important bits of advice. And I think we stick with what we know how to do and carefully scrutinize how much we're learning, what we're learning as we go.
So when you say we need more data, do you mean we need to know where the outbreaks are happening? As Dr. Fauci said earlier, that we need to know what's going on in the places where there are not outbreaks? And how do we get that information? I mean, is that not testing?
Yeah, no, part of this is much greater situational awareness with testing, both judicious and strategic uses of testing. We don't have the proper infrastructure and means of doing that right now. But it is clear that it's improving, and a week from now, 2 weeks from now, that will be much better. But at the same time, we will have data on what these case increase rates look like as these mitigation measures, the social distancing, the shelter in place, as that has had a chance to take effect, we'll be able to look and see. What kinds of benefits does it seem those afforded us, and were they worth the cost?
So we still very much need widespread testing. One of the reasons I asked is because, now that we've sort of missed that initial window to be able to strategically say where we should shut things down, where the outbreaks are really occurring, since we missed that, is it less of a priority to test now?
Yeah, I think what you say is true, but to an extent. We've missed some of the opportunity that we could have taken advantage of, but we haven't lost all of it. There is still an important value to much greater degrees of testing. We just have to be smart about how we use it. Can we test every single contact of every case and track them down and use testing across a broad population? Probably not, but we can use it to do judicious testing of close contacts, of people at risk, point surveys of key populations. There are various ways of using testing even now that I think would provide a lot of very valuable information.
Well, let me bring Mark in Burlingame into the conversation. And the number to call for questions, 866-733-6786. Again, post them on Facebook, Twitter at KQED Forum, or email them to forum@kqed.org. Mark in Burlingame, join us.
Yeah, hey, how you doing? Hey, I have a question. So this morning it was announced that Prince Charles has coronavirus, but the Duchess of Cornwall doesn't. Why is it that this is so contagious when a family is living together? Why doesn't the entire family always get it?
Mark, thanks. So why is it unlikely in some cases that spouses or family members don't get this if somebody has tested positive in that family?
You know, it's a really interesting phenomenon. Clearly, household transmission is a major component of the spread of this disease. But each household is a little bit different. They're not all the same. And it's unclear whether it may just have to do with, you know, social spacing within households. How much space do you have? What are your actual, you know, social interactions and practices? And maybe other risk factors that we simply haven't identified.
Well, Mark, thanks for the question. Let me see if I can bring Fred from Oakland into the conversation now. Hi, Fred.
Hi. I read an article a couple days ago in the New York Times that in South Korea, they test everyone, sometimes several times. And that way they have stopped the spread of the virus there. Why aren't we testing everyone?
Fred, yeah. Thanks. We touched on this, but David Relman, yes, can you explain the situation, the differences in the situation in South Korea and why they're actually now on a downward trend in terms of numbers of cases, numbers of new cases?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And again, it just points to the very different levels of preparedness that different countries had going into the start of this pandemic. Same with Taiwan, as with South Korea, as with Singapore. They had the infrastructure already placed, already ready for widespread testing, contact tracing. They had big teams of people who could go out and track down all these possible contacts and then get them tested. And by doing so, they were able to be much more, you know, sort of surgical in their approach to the control of the disease. They were just better prepared. We should have been. And we weren't.
David Roman, is it fair to say that these more severe social distancing, self-isolation, self-quarantining restrictions exist here or in California largely because we weren't able to do the testing and contact tracing needed?
I think it's a combination of factors. We have some very forward-thinking, very good, smart public health officials. And I think they looked at the data. They saw what was happening. They looked elsewhere in the world and they saw what the consequences were of not being proactive and aggressive early on and realized that the window for doing something important and helpful was closing. And they said, look, we're not going to wait. We're going to skate to where the puck will be, not where it is. And that's what they decided to do. I think it was a very smart thing. We don't yet know exactly how much benefit we may have bought by those measures. But as I say, we are going to know in weeks whether the curves are flattening, whether we have saved ourselves and, you know, deaths and bought ourselves time for these other various measures that we know that we can do with more time and resource.
There have been some high profile articles written by infectious disease specialists and epidemiologists that are calling for the U.S. to go much further, though. For example, calling for immediately closing all schools in the nation or all non-essential businesses and essentially imposing a shelter-at-home policy for the entire nation. Do you feel like that's necessary? They're saying we need to do a full-scale shutdown for 2 weeks to really get this.
Yeah, that's a hard one because there are two issues at play. One is, what would actually help in every location, and then realizing that every location has a slightly different story. Every location in this country has a different set of epidemiologic features. So what might be quite prudent and wise in one place may not be as wise in some other place, simply because at the same time you're buying some costs, some risks of economic hardship, of difficulty in getting critical services to places they're needed, et cetera. So I do think that a different size might be needed, a different approach in different locations, and that's where local data are really crucial.
Right, that's the problem, right? We don't have the local data yet to make
right.
it more targeted. Well, let me go to Carol in San Francisco. Hi, Carol, join us.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can, go right ahead.
Okay, yeah, my question, I work in healthcare, and I'm wondering if there is any information yet about if you've been exposed and had the disease, are you then going to be immune?
That's a great question, Carol, because David Remen, we're also hearing that the hope could be that the people who restart the economy in full force are the people who have had it, are immune and can be tested, and also even maybe their blood used as part of a cure or a vaccine.
Right, right. No, it's a great question. And I think the answer is still not yet entirely clear, but it's, I think, quite certain that there'll be some degree of immunity that results from having been infected. Whether it's complete immunity to subsequent infections and for how long, that's uncertain. But people do develop antibodies, and the nature of those antibodies is still to be determined. In other words, are they fully protective or partially protective, et cetera? And when does protection occur? But I think it's a great, great point, because the sooner we can start doing this kind of widespread antibody testing and then learning what those antibodies mean, the sooner we'll be able to deploy people, just as you say, who are at least partially protected into the front lines, into the healthcare settings where they're most at risk, into the key jobs where they're, delivering food to the elderly who are at most risk, or, working at checkout lines in grocery stores, et cetera. I think that's going to be a really important, aspect of how we respond and properly deploy people with, again, with more data.
Speaking of cures, but reminding me of treatments, this Arizona man who died after taking a non-medical form of chloroquine after the president was touting chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. I mean, how should Americans interpret claims about effectiveness of these drugs?
Boy, so I can't comment on that case. I don't know the details, but I think the point in general is important. There are some really interesting leads, and in most cases, these leads came out of laboratory testing of virus in, in flasks exposed to different compounds. Some of those findings are quite encouraging, but it's a really big jump from a laboratory flask to a human being. And we know that, because these are viruses, they have very intimate relationships with some of our own human proteins in biology. Anytime you try to tinker with that relationship and treat the virus, you're quite likely to mess with the human physiology, the human biology at the same time. And so that's why these drugs have potential toxicity. And I think, the sobering fact is that some of these drugs may have important side effects that make the treatment worse than you might think. But the good side is that there are lots of trials going on now. And for example, with chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, we're going to know a lot more in a month's time than we know now.
But in the meantime, be very cautious about what you hear about.
I would be very
cautious.
Yeah.
Well, Valerie writes, if two households have been isolating for 14 days and no one is sick, can they see each other?
Good question. Yes, in theory, they could do that. The proviso is that they have not had contact with other people. I mean, this virus grows in humans and is transmitted between humans. The environment is much less a risk, unless you're talking about a hospital environment or a heavily, heavily used surface. So yes, if these people have been entirely to themselves and with no others, and they've gone 14 days without signs of illness, then they're probably fine for interacting with each other.
Well, let me go next to caller John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Hi there. First, I want to give a quick shout out to the VA. My wife works at the VA here in San Francisco, and they were on top of this even a week before the rest of the county in the Bay Area in terms of infection control and keeping people out. So, you know, kudos to them for really taking it seriously in advance of the rest of the medical community. So my question was more broad. I was really curious. You had mentioned that because every locality is different, the strategy you use is different, and how you deploy testing is different. But what I'm not seeing is who's setting a national strategy to deploy those tests in the right place and get the data so that, you know, in Minnesota, you do it differently than the Bay Area because they don't see the same spread. I see everybody doing it themselves, every county,
Sean,
every city.
I think I understand your question. The line's not great, but I'm going to just try to paraphrase it for Dr. Relman. I think he's asking about who's going to set a national testing strategy.
Yeah, or who's going to set a general approach, you know, mitigation strategy for each of these locations. So, you know, in theory and ideally, the way it should work is the federal government sets the principles, establishes the general methods and approach that everyone will use, the sort of the general guidance on how one goes about doing this. How does one use data? And then the states and the counties look at their own data, assuming they have it, and apply these principles locally. So that's how it should work. Right now, the availability of data is very patchy, and the degree of general guidance that we're receiving from the federal government is also really patchy. And that then leaves the state health departments and the counties a little bit more on their own than you might like to see. But, you know, you do the best you can. And in many cases, counties and states are doing a really good job, I think, given the circumstances.
Yes. But I mean, in addition to being patchy, I mean, I would argue that it's between the federal government and the state and localities, it's like opposite. I mean, the governor has asked Californians to do an extraordinary thing by completely sheltering at home and only going out for essential duties. And I think people are just beginning to really feel what this means. And I cannot imagine that it's helpful to have the opposite message from our nation's highest office.
You're absolutely right.
I mean,
right.
How long can Newsom ignore Trump?
No, I think what he is saying is doing grave harm. And it's raising doubts about the, you know, the very well-founded decisions that were made locally. I'm entirely in agreement with you. But, you know, I guess my hope is that we know there are some smart people at the federal level, Tony Fauci among them, who know better, who know the importance of data and know what the data are saying and know that what the data are saying are not what our president is saying. And you have to hope that their voices are going to ring clear and be heard and preempt, you know, the occasional wayward and, in my view, you know, criminal comments that are made by the president sometimes.
I guess I'm just curious what criteria, you know, you would look at to determine whether current restrictions could be eased.
There are some very good models that look at the rate of new cases being identified, the rate of deaths occurring, and all of the testing data that are available in a given county. And what you do is you look at those charts, you look at those graphs, and you say, on this date, we did something. We established shelter in place. When does the model predict that we ought to see an effect? You wait that amount of time, and as I'm suggesting, it's about 3 weeks, and then you say, okay, does the prediction that the model made before we did this look the same or different from what we now see in actual fact? And if there's a discrepancy, well, you know, and the discrepancy is a positive one, then you say the measure seems to have done something good. Okay, now if we continue it as is, what's the prediction about where we are now? You know, in 3 weeks more time or a month more time. And, you know, you work incrementally with the best data you have and the best models that you have. And I think that is a very effective, reasonable approach. I'm hopeful that we're going to learn that what we're doing now is very useful. It was worth the pain. And it, believe me, I understand the pain of what people are going through. But, I mean, this is a critical time to learn what we're capable of doing to slow this down. And it's a time that is really not about me and what's right for me and my family. It's really a time for us all to consider what is right for our community. And we're going to have to act in our community's interest for the time being until, you know, these data and these models and this sound decision-making then says, okay, did this help or not? If it did, how much do we need to continue? What else can we try, et cetera?
And again, David Relman is professor of medicine at Stanford and infectious diseases chief at the Palo Alto VA. And yes, I do believe you share or understand, you know, the hardship that people are going through. I think I'm more just expressing some of my own frustration at the mixed messaging. But let me go to Philip in San Mateo. Philip, could you join us quickly?
Yes, thank you. Rightly so, we are conserving all the N95 masks and gloves as much as possible for the professionals that need them to serve sick people. But I am completely flabbergasted that if President Trump says we can roll out a ship a day during World War II, that we can't be rolling out shiploads of masks and gloves for people to wear. And I'm also continually insulted by people saying that, oh, well, the general public can't learn how to wear these properly anyway. If 3 out of 10 people learn how to wear these properly that do have to go outside, this will be another way to slow transmission.
Philip, thanks. David Oman, your response to Philip.
Yeah, I mean, he raises a more general issue, which is how can we ramp up production of these critical critical resources that we need for healthcare and for protection of individuals. I just don't think we are doing all that we could. I think this, again, this comes down to what's the role of local authorities and local ingenuity versus federal leadership. And here's where we're, again, lacking in the latter. We're actually quite blessed with the former, the local creativity and ingenuity here in the Bay Area. But this has to be coordinated. This has to be directed from above. And, you know, we're just not seeing all that we should and could see from the federal level. I just want to say one.
Yes.
But just
please.
One other thing about what's going on in the healthcare system. If anyone hasn't looked, you ought to look at what's happening right now in New York City and what is happening not only in Seattle, but now in New Orleans. People are being placed on ventilators in hallways of emergency rooms, and the ventilators are about to run out. I think people don't quite understand how bad this can get if we don't take this seriously and try as hard as we can to implement these mitigation measures now while we have some chance of doing good.
And do you think it's likely months that we have to do these mitigation measures?
Let's say a month or two. We certainly will know much better whether it was worth the effort by that point.
David Relman, infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine at Stanford, really appreciate having you on today.
Yeah, happy to have joined you.
And thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us for another hour of Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.